I'm so used to there being the end of song on the bottom there. I'm a robot trained to go by the signals. I missed it. So welcome. I'll add my thanks and welcome to all those that are with us both in person, which seems to be more and more each week, which is exciting, and those online that are joining virtually, those that are familiar with what we're doing here, have been here all the time, or those that are visiting, maybe for the first time or less familiar, we welcome you and hope that this is a time that is encouraging to you and that gives glory to God. If you are new or unfamiliar, you are jumping into the middle of a ongoing conversation this year about how we as Christians, using the Bible as our source of truth, see the world and everything in it. And this morning we're going to be talking about art and entertainment. And art is one of those things that we probably have a vague sense or a pretty good idea of what that might mean, but if you had to define it, it could be pretty tricky to try to give a good definition that would encompass everything that we would put into the category of art. But we want to talk about that this morning, and entertainment will be less of an explicit discussion in this lesson. But in as much of our entertainment comes from the consuming of art in its various forms, then there will be things to take from this lesson about the ways that we find entertainment in this life. So what are we talking about when we say art? As I said, it is difficult to define, so much so that this website I'm quoting from here has several paragraphs devoted to not really a definition of art, but all the different things that might show up in a definition of art. And I won't give you all of them, but just notice a few of the components that are common when we try to define what we mean by art. So maybe saying what it is most basically, art includes entities, that is artifacts, things, or performances, intentionally endowed by their makers with a significant degree of aesthetic interest, often greatly surpassing that of most everyday objects. Aesthetic interest means it's pleasing to the eye, pleasing to the ear, pleasing to the physical senses of touch or movement. And so there is beauty, there is this aesthetic endowment in art. But more than that, there is, this article goes on to say that such entities sometimes have a non-aesthetic, and they include ceremonial, religious, propagandistic functions, and sometimes do not. What does that mean? It means that art often sends a message, propaganda, or there's a religious message or a ceremonial function, but art is not just something that is pleasing, but oftentimes it is communicating something to those that are experiencing the art. And then along those lines, this article also includes that artworks can have considerable moral and political as well as aesthetic power. And that would kind of back up the point we've just tried to make, that art is not just something that is pleasing to the senses, but it's something that is communicating something and driving at something, we might say. So if we were going to boil all this down to get a sense of what we mean by art, I'll pull out those three things. Art includes things that are pleasing to experience, again, to the eye, to the ear, to the touch. It evokes emotion of some sort, and it communicates a message. That's what we're going to run with in terms of defining art. And in terms of examples, there are things that we're very familiar with, maybe even, in fact, things that we consume or involve ourselves with on a daily basis. Painting is maybe the most obvious of these, or drawings, but sculpture as well, of course, art. Music, dancing, literature of various forms, plays, drama, movies, TV shows, etc., etc. This is what we mean when we say art, and we're going to talk about these things. And hopefully maybe even just this list is a helpful reminder of how important this really is. Some of these lessons in the worldview series that we've been doing this year may seem more strange than others. Why are we talking about science from the pulpit? Why are we talking about sex in church? And maybe this one as well. Why are we talking about art? And if for no other reason, maybe this list shows us that these are things that we are in touch with all the time. And it's important then for us to think about our relationship to them. We've talked a lot this year about how God is the source of all things, and that everything that we talk about, we've tried to start with that, with God the Creator being the origin. Is that true of art? Is it true that God somehow created or would be considered the source of art? And I think that we would say absolutely that is the case. Two psalms that I'll draw your attention to. Psalm 8, the psalmist says, "When I consider your heavens, the work of your fingers, the moon and the stars which you have ordained, what is man that you are mindful of him, or that you take thought of him, and the son of man that you care for him?" You see what the psalmist is doing. Psalm 8 is a psalm about creation, and I look at what God has created, what he has made. He calls it the work of your fingers, the heavens. I think part of that is just to emphasize how big God is, okay? That even the heavens that are stretched out above the in the expanse, God made that with his fingers, okay? But I think it's also a metaphor of craftsmanship, that the heavens that are so beautiful, the clouds, the sunsets, the sunrises, the moon and stars that are mentioned in this psalm, it is beautiful. There is aesthetic value, as we know, to creation. But think about our other elements of art. Do you see the emotion that is evoked for the psalmist? Wow! The heavens and the moon and the stars are amazing. And you see from Psalm 8 that there's a message being communicated. The psalmist is thinking through this and seeing the revelation of God and saying, this tells me something about man's place in the universe, as the rest of the psalm goes on to describe. Maybe more clearly and more famously, Psalm 19, the first four verses, "The heavens declare the glory of God. The sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech, night to night reveals knowledge. There is no speech, there are no words whose voice is not heard. Their voice goes out through all the earth, and their words to the end of the world." This is maybe even more clear. And I think the word handiwork there in verse 1 is this idea of craftsmanship. And so God, through the creating of the heavens, the sky, of creation itself, is speaking those things, those pieces of art. What do we say? A picture is worth a thousand words or something like that. The creation of God shouts out to everybody that sees it, not only how beautiful it is, but it says something about their maker, and even says something about us as well. And we would include in that the passage from Romans 1 where Paul says that the things that are made communicate the invisible attributes of God, namely his eternal power and divine nature. I think this is pretty evident to us. Steve often refers to his favorite place in the world, Rocky Mountain National Park, as God's canvas. And I think we know exactly what he means by that. And so we would say that God is the source, the origin of art, because he has infused beauty, and in doing so, infused meaning as well, into the natural world. Okay, well, what about us? I think we know just from our observation that man does art, obviously. And I think if you're thinking in our worldview terms and about God being the source of all things and God making man in his image, we might realize that our desire, it's been true of humans all along, that we are creative, we like to design, we like to produce things that are pleasing to the eye or to the ear. I think we would put it all together and say that's part of being made in God's image, that we are like him, we are creative, and we can not only see beauty, but we can create beauty, and we can produce that. And so man imitates God in that way by doing art. And so maybe the question then becomes, was that a good thing, or is that a bad thing? What's the result of man imitating God and producing art? And so I want to go to the scriptures to try to answer that. And so what we'll do over the next few minutes is just sample several different passages that refer to different forms of art, not all of them, but several forms of art, and gives us a sense of the result of that or the value of those things or lack thereof. So let's begin with music, which is a popular art form. And it's interesting that the first mention of music, in particular musical instruments, comes in Genesis chapter 4 when the genealogy of Cain is being given. And it's interesting that several of the descendants of Cain in that line are responsible for the creation of things, like the first people to build cities and do metallurgy, and among other things, to create musical instruments. And I don't want to take this too far, but we should see that the line of Cain is not an admirable line. And that all these things that they're inventing for themselves and producing for themselves has their end in some ways in the Tower of Babel, this kind of look what we can make architecture and we can build for ourselves a city. We don't need God. We don't need to do what he says. And so there is a sense in which even the instruments of music were created for such a kind of self-serving purpose, perhaps. And yet, speaking of the lyre, we have a passage like 1 Samuel 16, where it says that whenever the harmful spirit from God was upon Saul, you remember that, when David had been anointed, Saul's kingdom is on the rocks, and he's troubled all the time by that. And so he calls in David. David took the lyre and played it with his hand, so Saul was refreshed and was well, and the harmful spirit departed from him. There's something about the playing of that instrument that brought healing and peace and comfort to the troubled mind and soul of Saul. And so the lyre, on that instance, is a good thing. It's a blessing. Along those lines, speaking of David, you may remember that David was responsible for organizing and planning the music that would take place in the temple worship. 1 Chronicles 25, verse 1, that David and the chiefs of the service also set apart for the service the sons of Asaph. Remember, there are some psalms attributed to Asaph. And Heman and Jeduthun, who prophesied with lyres and harps and cymbals. So, at the instruction of God, David planned that there would be musical instruments and music as a part of the temple worship, and that was a good thing. And yet, in the book of Amos, chapter 6, in the middle of a harsh rebuke on the rich and the complacent, those that are at ease, those that are just enjoying life with no regard for the Lord or regard for people in society that are hurting, woe to those who lie on beds of ivory, you skip down a little ways, who sing idle songs to the sound of the harp and like David, invent themselves for themselves instruments of music. Is this a good thing that the people are inventing music like David? No, it's not. It's a picture, it's a further picture of them serving themselves and the instruments of music. The music is a way to just luxuriously and complacently enjoy life without being serious about their covenant with God or their responsibility in society. So what do we see about music in these few passages from the Old Testament? Well, we see that it can go either way, we might say. And what's the difference between the music that we would say has a negative connotation and the music that we would say is positive? Well, a lot of it is purpose. What was the purpose of David putting together those groups or those instruments and those people to play and to sing in the temple? Well, it was to glorify God at his instruction to give him praise and honor. Or in the example with Saul, to be a blessing to others, whereas the other examples, the purpose is more about serving myself. And it's maybe even a sign of arrogance or of self-glorification, self-serving in some way. Okay, so at least the purpose, if nothing else, is different in those examples. Let's look at another one. What about dancing? Another art form that we may be familiar with. And one of the early examples of dancing in the Old Testament is the episode of the golden calf in Exodus 32 and verse 6. Upon constructing the golden calf, it says that they rose up early the next day and offered burnt offerings and brought peace offerings, and the people sat down to eat and drink and rose up to play. And it's very obvious that that word play has sexual connotations, and this was sexual activity that was taking place in worship of the idolatrous golden calf that had just been constructed. And if you look down at this party that's taking place throughout the chapter, you'll notice in verse 18 and 19 that it includes both singing and dancing, okay? What kind of dancing, we might ask, and we probably have an idea, and we see the connotation that is behind that. But just earlier in the book of Exodus, after God had delivered the people and led them through the Red Sea and swallowed up the Egyptians in the water, it says that Miriam the prophetess, the sister of Aaron, took a tambourine in her hand, and all the women went out after her with tambourines and dancing. And so they're dancing as a way to give honor to the Lord, to praise him, to celebrate what the Lord has accomplished. Let me ask you a question. I can't help myself here. We understand that the purpose of these two is very different. The reason for dancing is very different. Do you think the form of dancing was different in these two occasions? You think the movements that Miriam and her associates were performing in Exodus 15 were different than the movements that were being performed in front of the golden calf in Exodus 32? You think that's maybe the case? I would imagine so. A couple New Testament examples of this same sort of thing. Jesus, in the parable of the prodigal son, talks about this grand conclusion when the son returns and the father throws a party for him. It says that they began to celebrate. And the older son was in the field, came back and drew near to the house and heard music and dancing. So a celebration of dancing and singing and music when the prodigal son returns. And yet we remember another story in the Gospels about the daughter of Herodias, who came in and danced before Herod while he was drunk with his men at a party. And again, I would ask, what kind of dancing do we think Herodias' daughter was doing in front of Herod in Matthew chapter 14, and I think we would imagine what kind of dancing that was. And so now we have a couple things to say in terms of distinguishing between an art of dancing that is perhaps wholesome and in glory to God and dancing that is associated with sinfulness. There's a difference in purpose, clearly, what that is trying to accomplish, okay? What Herodias was trying to accomplish, what those at the party of the prodigal son were accomplishing, or Miriam, or the golden calf. The purpose is different, but also the form itself, the content is different, I think we would point out as well. Okay, we'll keep going. Craftsmanship. Craftsmanship is an interesting one. Think about sculpting and the relationship between the people of God and sculpture in the Old Testament. And probably the first thing that comes to mind is, like, you know, the Ten Commandments. When God said, "You shall not make for yourself a carved image, any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or in earth beneath, or that is in the earth, heaven above, earth beneath, or that is in the water under the earth." Why was it that these sculptures of any kind of animal or anything was forbidden? Well, it's because there's idol worship. There's the, as Paul says in Romans 1, the worshiping of the creature rather than the creator. And so this type of sculpture was forbidden by God because it was an exaltation of the creation over the creator. And so idolatry was forbidden. And yet, Exodus 35, we remember that when the tabernacle was built, and again, God, like in 1 Chronicles 25 with what David was doing with temple worship, you see in the book of Exodus, God is drawing the blueprints and Moses and the Israelites are following the construction plans according to what God has said. And so among other things, Bezalel, this craftsman, was called by God, and it says that he filled him with the Spirit of God with skill, with intelligence, with knowledge, and all craftsmanship to devise artistic designs, to work in gold and silver and bronze and cutting stones for setting and in carving wood for work in every skilled craft. So there was artistry, there was craftsmanship, there was embroidering and even sculpting. By the way, remember that this was also true in the temple that Solomon built, even maybe to a greater degree, and in fact, not to throw too much of a wrench into this conversation, but there were even forms of animals in the temple. Remember, there were bowls, B-U-L-L-S, that held up the basin, the big bowl, B-O-W-L, that was out front of the temple. There was 12 of them, represent the 12 tribes of Israel. And among other things, the crafting of this the cherubim on the Ark of the Covenant. And so why was that okay? Well, God's instruction, of course, would be one answer to that. But again, I think we would see there's a different purpose The things that Bezalel was crafting, the artistry that he did, or the artistry that was done in the temple, was for the purpose of pointing to God and not just evoking an emotion of, wow, look at all this amazing artwork, you know, and that is a humbling thing that draws us close to God. But it's even communicating something. The artistry of the tabernacle and temple was telling a story. It was telling a story about the garden and God's relationship with man. And even as we know now on this side of the cross, we know that the artistry of the tabernacle and temple was telling a story, a typological story, looking forward to Jesus when he would fulfill all these things that were represented physically in the tabernacle and temple. So again, the form is different and the purpose is different. If you ever have seen any artifacts of these idols from the ancient world, you may remember that there is oftentimes lewdness and sensuality that is a part of these physical images of the other gods. So the form is different for what God had designed, of course, and a different purpose. Let's keep going here. Last category we'll look at is literature. We understand that the verbal or the written art is something that we're familiar with because the Bible is that to a large degree. Think about this passage in Deuteronomy 31 when God is trying to communicate his covenant to the people for a second time and trying to get these people to really understand and hold to the covenant. And so he tells Moses to write a song and teach it to the people of Israel, to put it in their mouths, and the song would be a witness for me against the people of Israel. This passage in many ways represents what is the purpose of the written word that we have in Scripture. That God has communicated his will to us using writing. And not just writing in any form, but it is writing that is artistic. The stories that we have recorded in the Old Testament and the New Testament, they are true stories that are communicating real historical events. But they are communicated in a way that is, we would say, good storytelling. There is an art to the way that the writers of the Bible tell their stories, that craft their narratives. There is, as we've talked about, a lot of poetry in the Bible, songs and poems that communicate God's revelation to us. And so the principle in Deuteronomy 31 is that God intended for his word to be something that could be remembered, to make an impression like art does, to evoke an emotion as it communicates a message. And the word of God does that. It is beautiful aesthetically, and it makes an impression on us and communicates to us in doing so. But not all written word is good. This is an interesting passage from Ecclesiastes 12. The first part of it maybe goes along with what we've just been saying. The words of the wise are like goads. They are like nails firmly fixed are the collected sayings. They are given by one shepherd. Okay. There's our shepherd again in Ecclesiastes 12. And the one shepherd has given us words that can stick in our brains. But the author of Ecclesiastes also says, my son, beware of anything beyond these, of making many books there is no end, and much study is a weariness to the flesh. He says there's going to be a lot of writing. In fact, you know, this is still true today. In fact, books keep being made, even with so much visual technology and the internet. Books probably will never go away. At least Ecclesiastes 12 says it's going to go on and on, writing. But beware of it, because it's not all, maybe most of it's not going to be beneficial. Focus on the words that are really profitable for you, the Ecclesiastes writer says. And then in terms of literature, but I think this can be applied to this entire discussion, think about this as somewhat of a case study. In terms of the response, as we've said, if it's true that there is all this literature out there, or maybe more broadly, all this art out there, and much of it can be, you know, we can do without it, but some of it may be worthwhile, how should we respond to that? Well, you may remember the story in Acts chapter 19, where the people of Ephesus, having seen the power of God demonstrated through Paul's miracles and Paul's preaching of the gospel, were convicted, and they were converted to Christ. And it says that in Acts 19:19, that a number of those who had practiced the magic arts, that would be sinful practices, brought their books together and burned them in the sight of all. And they counted the value of them and found it came to 50,000 pieces of silver. This is literature of some sort that had been used previously in connection to pagan, idolatrous, sorcerous practices. And the people, upon being converted to Christ, said, this is wrong. Not only is it sinful, it's associated with my former life, and I just need to get rid of it. I need to burn it and just completely consume it. It's not worth anything. No value in it. And even the monetary value I'm willing to sacrifice just to get rid of these books. And yet, maybe in some ways, contrast that with a passage two chapters earlier in which the Apostle Paul is preaching to the philosophers in Athens, and he's explaining to these people that don't really have a great familiarity, as far as we can tell, with the Hebrew Scriptures, and he's trying to explain to them the principles of there being one God who has created everything, and all men are accountable to this one God. How do you do that without using the Scriptures? Well, he probably does get that in at some point, it seems like, but among other things, he says this in verse 28, in him we live and move and exist, and as even some of your own poets have said, for we also are his children. What am I getting at here? Paul quotes here from their own poets, and he says, for also we are his children. That is from a poet named Aretas and a hymn to Zeus that was composed maybe 200-300 years earlier than Paul. We're talking about pagan literature here, pagan Greek poetry. And yet Paul is familiar with it somehow in his education. But more than that, he's able to go back to that pagan literature and say, you know what? Even though they were totally off about who should be deserving the praise, they were onto something. There's a nugget of truth in that poem about how all of us as humans derive our existence from a single God. And that's exactly the point that Paul is trying to make in Athens. This is not the only time Paul does this. In fact, some have noted that even the first line of this verse, in him we live and move and exist, comes from Greek literature, and other places in Paul's epistles, he does the same thing, quoting from plays or from philosophers of the current, or at least contemporary culture. Think about that. That some literature was burned, no value at all, and yet some literature, there were things that Paul could take from it and say, yeah, there's truth there that we can gain in our understanding of God and our place. So, all of this to say, what do we make of man's involvement in and creation of arts? Well, like many of the other things that we've said this year, art can glorify God, and we've talked about ways in which that's possible, but oftentimes, maybe you want to say usually, most of the time, art is used by man to promote sinfulness. And why is that? And I want to run through just a few things here about why it is that art is so often connected to or associated with sinfulness and why it's a danger, okay? And hopefully by this point in the lesson, you'll understand that what I'm about to say is not all the reasons why art in itself is sinful, okay? But this is a list of things that why there are common dangers or threats associated for the Christian in the world of art. The first one is that there is so commonly, especially in our world, the glorification of the one producing the art. We are so familiar with that, I wonder if it's maybe even like not even noticed anymore. That there are, you know, giant billboards of people, right? And thousands of people crowding into arenas to, you know, wave their hands and to scream and shout for a person who is performing something, okay? Or when they die, kind of they are literally enshrined with a star or with a statue to remember this person. And we think, well, isn't that kind of like idolatry? But we say, oh, of course, no, that's not what that is. Maybe it's not, but we realize that is so much of what art is worshiping or glorifying the artist himself or the artist herself. This was not really always the case in our civilization. It's interesting, and I may say a little bit more about this, but the Renaissance, you might remember if you're familiar with guys like Da Vinci and Raphael and Michelangelo, you know, all the Ninja Turtles. Those guys about 500 years ago or more, that's the high point of art in our civilization. And there's a lot of beauty in that. But one of the things that happens in the Renaissance is that there is more attention being drawn to the artist himself. People start signing their works and labeling that they're the one that wrote something. And that, as we see now this many years later, has really come to its maybe absurd fullness in glorifying the artist. But the other thing that art commonly does is it objectifies and it worships the thing that is the subject of the art itself. It's actually another thing that happens as a result of the Renaissance. If you're familiar with Renaissance art, you know that it's just unbelievably astounding how realistic they were able to paint the human body or a scene of nature or wonder of wonders to take a hunk of marble and to carve it down to where it looks like a real human body. And there was something in that that was derived from a respect for God and a reverence for God and man's place in the world. Most of the people in the Renaissance were operating in a worldview that said, man is special, man is great, man is wonderful because God has created him in his image and placed him in this exalted role in creation. So the art of the Renaissance shows that. But of course, where that goes is that we very quickly lose sight of this whole reason why man is special, that God created him, and we just kind of run with, well, man is great. Man is awesome. Man is wonderful. And so from the Renaissance on, art becomes more and more about man, how great man is, and the object of the art becomes the thing that is exalted. And along those lines, art more and more and maybe the nature of it, maybe because it is so aesthetically pleasing, it's pleasing to the ear, it's pleasing to the experience, it's pleasing to the eye, so much of art then focuses on that. And maybe even sometimes departs from the element of meaning and communicating a message, and art is simply created to make you feel good, okay? Maybe especially now as our culture, our world is losing touch with meaning and reality. Movies are made, music is produced that has almost no message whatsoever, but it just sounds good. It's just fun. It's just good to experience. And so much of art is that. Again, especially in a fallen world or in a society that has lost touch with the foundations of truth. And along those lines, you're probably familiar with the idea that in the world of art, there is such an emphasis on expression. Art is about expressing yourself. And we can see that maybe from some of the reasons that if you're focused on being an artist and the kind of romanticism of that, and you're focusing on, you know, what I'm producing as an artist, and it's to make us feel good and to experience pleasure, well, then art is all about then just expressing yourself. And as a Christian, again, I think we should notice that there is real danger in that kind of emphasis, that it's all about me being free to be and do what I want to be and do without restraining myself with some kind of antiquated notion of, you know, values or truth or morality. Art is really, again, more and more antagonistic to that sort of discipline or restraint. Just be free. And the last thing I'll say about the dangers of art is that it will, I think, know this or understand it, that art then uses the beauty and the emotional power of it, of the art form, to communicate ideas that are contrary to what a Christian worldview would or should promote, okay? This happens in music, happens in movies, and maybe it's happening more, maybe it's always the case. And this is the kind of thing that, you know, maybe we're a little bit, you know, hesitant to, well, I don't want to be like a conspiracy theorist and think that all these people are making movies and making music just to, like, you know, communicate bad ideas, you know. And are we saying, like, if you listen to Stairway to Heaven backwards, it, you know, says praise Satan or something like that? I think maybe all that we're trying to say is that a person's worldview and a person's values automatically find their way into the art that they are producing, okay? If you wrote a story, tried your hand at doing that, I would hope and would be pretty certain that the values of Christianity would find their way into that story you wrote. because that's what happened. Art is an expression of our hearts and minds, and so the values of the world are going to find their ways into the art that is produced and that is marketed in our society, and we need to be aware of that, and we shouldn't rule out the possibility that there are people that are explicit or are intentionally creating art for the purpose of expanding the notions in our society of what should be accepted or what is okay or what kind of value should be upheld. And again, I think that point would be fairly intuitive if we think about it long enough and know of our own experiences with the art that we consume. Okay, all that to say, what is it that we should take? Three things that I'll just say as we wrap up. One is that we should appreciate goodness, truth, and beauty wherever it should be found. We understand that the world is full of beauty. The world is full of goodness, and that there is truth in all these different forms. We should look for it, and we should find it, and we should cling to it. Abhor what is evil, cling to what is good. And as Christians, we, maybe more than anybody, have a sense of what really is beautiful. And we can find that, we can appreciate that when we do find it. But we also should be conscious of the messages conveyed, the feelings that are evoked in the art that we consume. Oftentimes when we're talking about consuming art, we have questions like, you know, well, is it explicit in its, you know, sexual content or in its, you know, language that's being used or the violence that is being portrayed? I think those are good questions to ask, and we should ask those questions, but I don't think those are the only questions that we should ask. What about asking, well, what is this work of art? What is this movie? What values is it upholding? What is it promoting? This show that I'm watching, what are the, again, the value, what is the worldview expressed in this TV show or this song that I enjoy or this artist that I listen to? And maybe even more, or not more, but maybe harder than that, what emotions is it evoking in me? Maybe I would say it's clean in an explicit sense, but maybe it's just, you know, sexualized enough, or the costumes are just enough to where it is evoking in me a certain, sexual desire that is unhealthy, right? Or maybe there's a music that doesn't have any explicit bad language, but it's intended to make me angry and to kind of live with like clenched fists and, you know, everybody's out to get me kind of thing. You understand what I'm saying? That art is so complex in the way that it infiltrates us. And we enjoy it, but there is emotions that are evoked and there is values that are sinned, so we need to be conscious of that. And let me say one more thing about that. I would imagine, that's what I've been saying, so you can't help it, I guess. I would imagine that when you see this sentence, be conscious of messages conveyed, feelings evoked by the art we consume, you're probably thinking, okay, yeah, I need to know what to avoid, right? And if I'm being honest, when I wrote this sentence for the first time, I probably was thinking, yeah, this is what we need to avoid. But let's talk about it in terms of the positive as well. That I need to be conscious of values and emotions and to be looking and seeking out things, art that is good for me. To be on the lookout and to be interested in good books, good music, good visual media. Okay, and in what sense do I mean good? Well, because it is infused with goodness, truth, and beauty, it's beneficial for the soul. I need to be looking for those things actively. If I'm only saying, well, I just got to avoid things that are bad, well, then we probably will be deficient in the way that we are entertaining ourselves or consuming art. But if we're conscious of, you know, I'm going to find something that is valuable for me, not only in its message, but in its beauty and its emotion, and I'm going to seek that out to make me better as a person. And that may all seem really weird, and that's maybe one of the reasons why we don't always do very good at this. It's because we don't want to be strange. I don't want to be the parent that doesn't allow my kid to, you know, go to this school function, or I don't want to be the weirdo that, you know, has to like read all the books before my kids read them. I don't want to be the person at the office that's like, no, I haven't seen that movie. No, actually, I haven't seen that one either. No, I don't know, you know, who that artist is. All that kind of stuff is hard for us because we don't like being left out. We want to be up to date with what's going on, and we want to enjoy what other people are enjoying. But hopefully we remember from our discussion of worldview that that's just not going to happen. If we're really trying to serve the Lord and represent him in this life, we're always going to be strange. We're always going to be weird. And in this maybe especially, we're just not going to consume and appreciate the same art that the world appreciates and consumes. And again, it's something that we've already said in the first 2 points. I hope that we will be people that consume and appreciate good art in the true sense of that. But not that we would be people that consume all the most popular art that is available in our society. And that's a distinction that I think is important. That we can be those that are benefited by good media, good entertainment, but keep our distance and see the error and the danger in the things that are popular. And maybe all of this is summarized by the Apostle Paul in Philippians 4:8 when he says, "Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things." Let's do this. Let's seek out the things that are true and lovely, pure, commendable, honorable, the things that are worthy of praise. Let's fill our lives, our minds, our eyes, our ears, our time with these things. And he goes on to say that the result of that is peace that we have only in the Lord. But that peace that we experience is only possible if we will see the world correctly. If, like Jesus says, our eyes will be healthy and undivided and whole. And that's been the goal of these lessons this year. If you don't have that peace because you're not in Christ, and you're thinking about how you view the world, and there's something fundamental missing, which is that you're not even in a covenant relationship with Jesus, and want to make that change, this is an opportunity to do that if you need some help. But let's sing one more song, "Jesus, I Come," and if you need something, come to the front as we stand and sing it.
Have my heart.